morning and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington, and here are some of the top stories making news across South Sudan, Sudan, and the rest of the region this Thursday, October 3rd, 2024. After the president moved his spy chief to another job, one analyst says he should distribute jobs more fairly.
The only problem is that some of these sensitive positions becomes more tribalistic because a dinka from his own area is now being appointed to replace the current dinka person. So that's the concern with people because it should be a position that any South Sudanese can be able to ascend to.
And Upper Nile state lawmakers approve a budget, but does it include money for flood victims?
Governor Upper Nile state will work very hard to allocate some for the returnees and also for the people that have been affected by the flood.
And more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. South Sudan's president, Salva Kiir, surprised many in the country by removing the long-serving director general at the Internal Security Bureau and naming him the Warup state governor. Dennis Lugonye has more for VOA from Juba.
On Wednesday evening, President Kiir removed General Akol Kurkuch as Director General of the Internal Security Bureau, or ISB, and then appointing him to serve as Governor of Warup State. Akol replaces Governor Kulmor, who was removed Wednesday also. Kiir appointed Akech Tong Aleu to be the new Internal Security Bureau Director General. No reason was given for the moves, which were announced on the state television station, SSBC. Boboya James is an independent policy analyst, and he thinks these moves partly to address tensions between the National Security Service and the Tiger Division, which protects the president. He says it appears Kiir wants to consolidate power.
There's been a lot of reckoning in terms of what to do with Akol Kul. The president doesn't want to cause a very rapid decision to cause a problem with national security and the Tiger Division. So what he did was just to keep waiting and waiting and waiting to watch, you know, the back of Akol Kul.
Akim Majest is a professor at Dr. John Garang University. He says the news of the spy chief's transfer has created some fear in the country since no reason was given for the move.
Let's just take it as a normal routine, just a normal process where maybe the new blood are needed in the National Security Services. They just take it that way. And again, maybe the president thinks that this guy will be effective in that new role as a governor of Warup State, because you know Warup is engulfed or communal issues going on there. Maybe the president thinks that this guy is the solution.
Boboya thinks that although the president has power to appoint and fire people in top positions, he should share the jobs equitably and rotate them among the regions and communities.
The only problem is that some of these sensitive positions becomes more tribalistic, because a dinka from his own area is now being appointed to replace the current dinka person. So that's the concern with people, because it should be a position that any South Sudanese can be able to ascend to.
Hakim says it's too early to say much about the shift in the political and military ranks, and that people should give it time to understand the moves.
This creates a situation of uncertainty, because you don't know what is really going to happen now, especially when you change somebody who has stayed in one position for too long and also has roots almost everywhere in all the institutions. When you just change it like that, you don't know what is really going to happen.
Boboya says resources are always wasted when such top-level changes are made, and he wants the leadership to ensure public property is controlled.
It's becoming cult in South Sudan when such high-level profit people are actually usually are shot, so many assets then disappear. So it's as a burden for taxpayers, people who pay taxes to finance government in this country, that each time there are these kind of changes in government, a lot of assets keep getting lost, and then a lot of taxpayers' money has been used to replace some of those assets.
Akol, a long-time Kiir confidant, became the head of the National Security Service after independence in 2011. For VOA News, I'm Dennis Logonye reporting from Juba.
Upper Nile State's Minister for Finance has presented a budget in the state's parliament for the first time in 11 years. Authorities say this budget will cushion humanitarian shocks across the state, exacerbated by floods and the influx of returnees and refugees from Sudan. Mamer Abraham Kwat reports for VOA from Malakal.
State Finance Minister Paul Deng presented the Upper Nile State Draft Budget of Financial Year 2024-2025 in the state's parliament on Wednesday.
The total resources of Amadu FXP, 41,862,387,334. The financial excellence of the
expanding agencies amount to 35,735,988,864, which constitute almost 85% of the total resource available. We thank the UN family, especially the UNDP, for technical support that they have provided, because our wish the ministry could encounter more challenges in preparing this financial year 2024-2025 budget.
It's the first budget proposal sent to the state parliament in 11 years, and it comes 4 years after the signing of revitalized agreement on the resolution of the conflict in South Sudan in 2018. Civil servants have not been paid for about 11 months in South Sudan. State and national officials have said there wasn't enough money to cover salaries because oil revenues have fallen sharply over the past 11 months because the war in neighboring Sudan has blocked access to oil pipelines. Upper Nile State Minister for Information, James Batcher, says the state had been depending on a budget set more than a decade ago after the outbreak of conflict in 2013. He says the state has been operating with the 2% oil revenue allocation it receives from the national government since then to cover expenses, and really did not have any clear developmental plan.
All these 10 years, they are using the budget of, I think, 2010 or 2012, 10 years now. They've just been receiving salaries accordingly to the budget of 10 years past. Some few things are not included in the old budget. Even the development was not there. And just they said was depending on 2%, and there is not any plan done in last budget.
Upper Nile State is among the states that have seen a large number of refugees and returnees from Sudan. It has also been hit by natural disasters such as recent floods, which are making conditions even worse in communities. Lone Bill is the spokesperson of Upper Nile State's parliament. He says the parliament will ensure that funds are allocated for emergency response programs.
There will be allocation for the disaster risk and management, as now the government of Governor Upper Nile State will work very hard to allocate some for the returnees and also for the people that have been affected by the flood.
Jacob Dollar, the parliament speaker, urges state ministers to perform their duties fairly. He warns that those who do not carry out the will of the people will be held accountable.
It is our responsibility as the leaders of this state to ensure that the services reach to our people. My priority is to work towards bringing peaceful coexistence within our community in this state. I'm here to urge the all honorable ministers in their respective ministry to take their role seriously. Failure to do so will result in the state of summer. It is our side role to ensure that the will of the people they represented is respected without fear and fear.
The state's Council of Ministers passed this budget on September 24th. The budget for the financial year 2024-2025 allocates 7.8% of the funds to Health Ministry, and the Ministry of Cabinet Affairs would receive 6%. The Ministry of Housing, Land and Public Utilities, which handles disaster risk management, will be given 4.4% of the budget. Rang County, where large numbers of refugees and returnees from Sudan have settled, has a 5.5% budget allocation, while Maban County, which also hosts refugees from Sudan, gets 1.4% of the budget. For VOA News, I am Amera Bramcourt, reporting from Upper Nile State's capital, Malakal.
Most hospitals in the Khartoum area of Sudan have been destroyed or evacuated as fighting in the capital continues. VOA gained rare access to a hospital still operating in the area and to one gutted by the flooding. As rights groups say, those responsible for the devastation should be held accountable for war crimes. Henry Wilkins reports.
Hamida Abdel Manim Abdel Rahim was injured in crossfire in Sudan's Khartoum area in early September.
The bullets were all over my body, my hands, my stomach, and my legs. I lost a lot of blood. Both my legs got shot. Both of them are broken. Also, one toe was amputated on this foot, and two toes were amputated on the other foot.
She is a patient at the Al Nahou Hospital, one of only a handful of hospitals still operating in Khartoum, a capital city ripped apart in Sudan's civil war. The World Health Organization says only 16% of healthcare facilities were operating in the capital region as of July, citing Khartoum's health authority. Human rights lawyers say that both sides in the conflict, the Sudanese Armed Forces, or SAF, and the Paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, are responsible for the destruction of hospitals. Christian DeVos, an adjunct professor at the City University of New York School of Law, has been observing the situation in Sudan.
The hospitals have been subject to indiscriminate shelling. Reasonable basis to conclude that that has been perpetrated both by RSF forces as well as SAF forces.
On a recent trip to Omdurman across the River Nile from Khartoum, VOA visited the so-called Chinese hospital, which has been gutted since the war started.
This hospital is under the control of the Sudanese military. They say they took back control from the paramilitary rapid support forces in February of this year.
It's not clear which side is responsible for the destruction of the hospital. The SAF told VOA that security personnel stationed in the hospital were police and volunteers there to deter thieves. Rights groups say military use of hospitals is banned under international law. The SAF are not the main culprits for illegal occupation of hospitals, however, says Letitia Badder of Human Rights Watch.
In terms of the occupation of hospitals, this has been very much more on the RSF side.
For hospitals in Sudan, which could amount to war crimes. The RSF told VOA in a statement, the rapid support forces have not occupied or destroyed any hospitals. These accusations are completely untrue, and blamed the SAF for violations. Henry Wilkins, VOA News, Omdurman, Sudan.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Coming up on South Sudan in Focus, Israel's latest airstrike on Lebanon kills 9 people. Does Israel have an exit strategy? More on that when we come back.
Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202-630-8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202-630-8011.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. The Eastern Libyan Legislature and the High Council of State signed a deal to resolve the crisis of Libya's central bank. The House of Representatives voted unanimously to adopt the agreement to settle the crisis following talks with the High Council under the United Nations support mission in Libya. Raynan Smith, managing editor of the media outlet Libya Analysis, explains to VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shanawi whether the government can help stabilize Libya.
It's important to say this is a very important agreement. Libya, for the last 5 weeks, has not been able to access any of the international systems or transactions. Prices are rising, economic things are getting much, much worse. So the fact they've been able to reach an agreement is very positive. That because the different sides have agreed to a new CBL governor who has just today been sworn in, that he should be able to take control of the central bank, resume a lot of these international transactions, and in theory, stabilize the situation. However, there's still a long way to go until that happens. That the first hurdle they've got to overcome is they've got to agree a board for the central bank within the next 2 weeks. I think we'll see quite a lot of political maneuvering around who gets appointed to that board. When the new governor then takes control of the bank, which it seems likely he will be able to do, he's still then got to deal with a huge amount of economic issues that were already in existence prior to the crisis of the last month. Around lack of cash, no value of the dinar, huge public spending around other issues. And so I think that's going to be a big challenge. And against the backdrop of all of this, although the parties have agreed to this kind of consensus, it's really a kind of agreement of convenience and because there weren't many other options. So I think we're still going to see political maneuvering and different attempts to try and sway the influence of the new central bank. So I think it's overall positive. And then the next few weeks, we're going to see kind of how in reality this new board is able to function. Are they able to take the decisions that they need to, and will they be enforced effectively?
The acting head of the United Nations support mission in Libya, Stephanie Khoury, said the agreement highlights the ability of the Libyan parties to overcome challenges when the national spirit prevails and to put the interests of the Libyan people as a priority above all else. Does that mean the Libyan rivals can reach a political solution?
Unfortunately, I think the short answer to that is no. Now, that is because although they've reached agreement on this central bank issue, that was mainly because the Presidential Council and Prime Minister Dbeibah, who kind of initiated the crisis, were really put into a corner and didn't have many other options because they couldn't access these kind of international funds. On the political level, we still see that the Dbeibah government in Tripoli wants to retain power. We're seeing the authorities in eastern Libya would like to get rid of them. None of these status co-actors really want to lose their positions or power of influence, especially now they've kind of managed to access or, you know, kind of gain some control over the central bank through this agreement. I would also argue that it was not the interests of the Libyan people that kind of motivated this agreement. If it had been, they would have reached an agreement when it first started without letting the country get into such a dire economic state as it is now. Unfortunately, I think we're still seeing the kind of Libyan elites acting in their own self-interest, which is what we've seen for many years. And unfortunately, I don't see that that has actually fundamentally changed. So although there may be some momentum now for kind of UN-led dialogue, so we may see some more talks, I'd be surprised if we saw a significant kind of progress on the political side in the coming weeks, although I hope I'm wrong about that.
So what's needed from the UN now to advance the long-awaited elections in Libya?
I think it is trying to take the momentum from the central bank agreement to bring the actors together. I think, to be honest, the main area that could make a difference, it will be around the economic side. If they can persuade or work with the actors to agree a unified budget, so some sort of mechanism whereby not only the control of the central bank, but actually where the oil revenues, where this money is spent, that has been the main driver of political security conflict in Libya for many, many years. So I think if they can convert this central bank agreement into some sort of, you know, financial mechanism to oversee spending, that could provide a basis to reach some sort of political negotiation around that. But I think from the UN's perspective, it's trying to get them all in the same room and push those talks forwards.
That is Rainin Smith, managing editor of media outlet Libya Analysis. She was speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi. Lebanon's health ministry says an Israeli airstrike in Beirut killed at least 9 people and injured 14 others overnight. It is the deadliest airstrike inside the capital since the fighting broke out between Israel and Hezbollah. This as Israel continues its military campaign in Gaza and is fighting other Iranian proxies along its borders. I asked Middle East political risk analyst Andreas Krieg at King's College in London if Israel has an endgame.
No, absolutely not. I mean, it hasn't had an end game in Gaza. Certainly has none in the West Bank. And obviously everything, all of that is related to what's going on in southern Lebanon. So there's still no end game there. So we're looking at a different stringing together of different tactical and operational objectives to kind of make up an overall strategy. But obviously that's not how it works. It's very much bottom up. And this is also why Israel has been continuously over the last 12 months kind of trapped in what we call mission creep, which means they're kind of creeping from one to the next objective without a real achievable end game in place. And if the overall objective is obviously to return Israeli citizens to northern Israel and doing that safely, then you need to create a situation where Hezbollah A cannot fire and doesn't fire rockets anymore, and B, you need to be able to maintain this status, that even if you were to achieve it in southern Lebanon, you need to be able to maintain it. So just seizing ground. And then potentially, obviously, the argument is they don't want to hold the ground. They want to retreat then. And even holding it would be extremely risky, will be requiring quite a lot of capacity. And then holding it for an extensive period of time, or then withdrawing from it, would create a vacuum where Hezbollah would move back in. So I think the overall objective now is degradation, eroding command and control, communications, and the ability for them to launch missiles. The longer this will go on for, as long as that's going on for, Hezbollah will continue striking and will try to hit Israel where it hurts.
Hezbollah is much stronger than Hamas. And as you said, Israel wants to degrade Hezbollah, and that's why they've gone in. But can it continue fighting on these multiple fronts like this for several months now? And how can it do that without the United States getting more involved?
They can. I mean, the U.S. is already complicit in all of this. Obviously, they're underwriting the entire campaign. And that's the big problem because, you know, whoever's going to be the next president is saying that the U.S. should not be drawn into this sort of conflict. And they are being drawn in already, whether this is with Iran or just by obviously delivering billions of dollars worth of military aid to Israel for a war that seems to be now, you know, it's the longest war in Israel's history. Netanyahu has been unable to deliver on any of the objectives in Gaza. So Hamas has been degraded, but still operational hostages on a home. Tunnel system still intact. Hamas is still able to launch, even if it's much less than before, able to launch attacks. So I do think that this, the same scenario will probably happen in Lebanon because Hezbollah is stronger than Hamas. It's better prepared. It had 18 years to do so, had a lot more support from Iran, has a tunnel infrastructure that is very, very much intact, much deeper underground, constructed by engineers from Iran, North Korea. So, you know, the situation is far worse than in Gaza. And you have an IDF that is now bogged down on four fronts, Lebanon, West Bank, Gaza, and Iran. So there's a massive overstretch.
You say that, you know, they need a quick win. And we're also talking timing with the U.S. election coming up in just a month or so. I mean, how does this affect the whole campaign here in the U.S. with trying to make Israel force Netanyahu to, a long time ago, try to reach a ceasefire and that it's not happening? What does it do to the political side of things?
Well, obviously, the United States looks tremendously weak. I think in the history of the Middle East, of, you know, the very fairly short history that the U.S. had in the Middle East over the last, you know, five decades, the U.S. has never looked as weak as they are looking at the moment. Completely undecisive. Don't know what they want. They say on one hand that we want Israel to stop, but we're also delivering more weapons. It hasn't. There have been several red lines the U.S. put in, whether it was going into Rafah, whether it was about going into Lebanon. There were a couple of ceasefires the U.S. has presented to the Netanyahu government. Every single time, red lines were crossed, ceasefires and off-ramps were ignored by the Netanyahu government, and the U.S. has done very little, pretty much nothing. And there's been some reputational issues, you know, where the U.S. has called out publicly the Israelis, but there haven't been any real coercive consequences for that.
That is Andreas Krieg, a Middle East political risk analyst at King's College in London. He was speaking with me earlier today. Americans are preparing to vote early next month in what promises to be a very close presidential race. Like most Americans, members of the African diaspora community face a stark choice when deciding which direction the country should go. Jeff Swikard spoke with both a Trump and Harris supporter to get a sense of their very different lived experiences.
The Bon Seum is a very industrious man.
We're going to leave at Rotoran for a few minutes.
He works long hours running a small trucking company with three long-haul trucks.
Hey.
He came to the U.S. with his family to escape the war between Ethiopia and Eritrea in 2000.
You got a kill switch on this truck?
They forced people to leave their countries, and that caused a lot of problem for a lot of families at that moment, and a lot of families actually moved to the States.
Laban considers himself a fiscal and social conservative and is a big supporter of President Donald Trump.
When President Trump was in power, it was an amazing type of business, you know, the market was great. The job opportunities were great, and people were optimistic.
When it comes to his trucking business, Laban is feeling the pinch of high fuel prices, and that he blames on President Biden. He says during the Trump administration, fuel prices were in the $3 a gallon range.
Right now, unfortunately, with the gas prices, is hovering around $5 for the diesel, $4.50, $5 for the diesel. And as you know, transportation is the bloodline of the United States. Almost 70% of the goods are moved through trucks like this.
Global oil prices are extremely volatile and set by a complex set of factors. Laban insists former President Trump has the answer.
Trump showed us the way to do it. You drill, you drill, you drill, you drill, and then you compete. You see, now we don't need to explore other ideologies.
Democrats, like Fatmata Berry, see the choice in this election very differently. She came to the U.S. at the age of 11 from her native Sierra Leone. After law school, she settled in Montgomery County, Maryland, to pursue her passions.
community advocacy, and immigration law.
Looking good. My dream would have been to have the kind of work where I can do the community work and still make a good enough living to live well.
Fatmata is a fierce advocate for civil rights, women's rights, and immigrants. She will be supporting Kamala Harris this November.
I think Vice President Kamala Harris is a person for the people. She is the person we need right now to bridge the divide that is in this country.
She is worried about Trump winning the presidency again.
The black community is being hurt more by the illegal aliens.
I am scared. The fear of immigrants is starting up again. The fear of black and brown people is starting up again. And it's hard when the person on top is leading it, so everyone else feels comfortable.
She says if the past is any guide, immigrants following the legal process will also be impacted by his plans to deport an estimated 11 million illegal migrants from the U.S.
And when they go for the interviews, they're doing it legally. They're detained and they're held. And some have been deported when they were not supposed to be deported.
Today, she is volunteering at a food bank.
Where do you want it?
She says although economic indicators are strong, there are many who are still falling between the cracks.
We look at the numbers, and the numbers look good, but there are people who are being missed, who we don't always think about, the hourly wage earners, the people who there are two, three families living in one home. The contrast basically is that the top 0.1% will have all the money and the rest of us will be struggling if you go with Trump. And the nation was never built like that. America became America because of the work that the blue-collar workers did in this country.
Two distinct visions for America, two distinct choices for the future. Jeff Swicord, VOA News, Silver Spring, Maryland.
And that wraps it up for us this Thursday. We invite you to check out voaafrica.com for all your favorite programs and news updates. If you somehow missed this broadcast, just head on over to www.voaafrica.com/South Sudan. We now leave you with the song Samira by South Sudan Abyei Jazz Band. Listening to Samira by Abyei Jazz Band. I'm your host, Carol Van Dam, in Washington, D.C. On behalf of our engineer, Bill Andrade, and producer, Kwame Ofori extraordinaire, thanks for tuning in. We'll see you back here tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Samira, jani, jani, Samira, yo. Samira, jani, jani, Samira, yo.